Please join me in welcoming Professor Fogel.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here. So, paleobiology, as I see it, is in the business of reconstructing the past. We want to know how this planet has changed over deep evolutionary time, what happened to the species that once lived here, and how are they related to us. Now, the iconic images, at least that I associate with paleobiology, are those adventurous men and women that are out at the edge of the wilderness, coming up with these momentous discoveries of fossils with just their rock hammer and determination to help them out. So what use do those adventurous scientists have for mathematical models? Well, those fossils only give us a tantalizing glimpse into the deep evolutionary past, and the mathematical models that have been developed in evolutionary biology can help constrain, supplement, and maybe even augment our hypotheses about prehistory. And so what I want to do today is look at two instances of modeling and how it might intersect with paleobiology, and in particular I have human paleobiology in mind, right? So the first is the role sequence evolution models play in molecular tests for natural selection. So with the boom in molecular data, these new tests that can find the signature of natural selection just by looking at molecular sequences have becoming more and more important and more popular, particularly applied to humans. Right? So I'm going to look carefully at how those tests presume a model of how those DNA sequences have evolved over time and what the role that model plays in the inference. The second instance is how evolutionary models of cooperation, kin selection, group selection, evolutionary game theory, have informed hypotheses about the evolution of human cognition and social behavior, sort of recent paleobiology, if you will, right? There's a new movement to think hard about how humans evolved to be such strange, cognitively complex creatures, and what sorts of adaptations or what sorts of changes led to that accelerated evolution of our cognition. And these days, a lot of theorists are making connections with cooperation. And so I want to look at that, too. And then I'll wrap up by making a comparison and noting an interesting and perhaps important coincidence. Okay, so first to frame. Evolution by natural selection occurs when there's variation in some trait. That variation is responsible for differences in evolutionary fitness, and the trait is heritable. Now, this process can leave signatures. And what I call a signature of selection is a detectable trace that's going to cohere with some specific selection hypothesis. Right? So we can look for signatures in morphology. We can look for them in fossils, comparing fossils. We can look for them by comparing molecular sequences. And that's what I'm going to look at today. There's an epistemic risk that accompanies this search for the traces of selection. Such signatures may be artifactual. That is, they may cohere with some selection hypothesis, but be produced by different causes. So evolution, if it's anything, it's complicated. And there's a complex constellation of causes that produce the forms and diversity we see today. And we might posit selection as being responsible and be mistaken. So what we want to do, what we want our tests to do, when they detect these signatures, they want to guard against this epistemic risk. We want to make sure we're not being fooled or honing in on an artifact. Okay. So molecular signatures, the methods used to detect molecular signatures use sequence data, primarily DNA sequence data, but you can do a lot of these tests with protein sequence data as well. There's a whole set of these. So some tests look at the ratio of non-synonymous to synonymous substitution rates in genes, so the changes that make a difference to the protein structure and the changes that don't. The idea is that the synonymous changes will give us a sort of signal, sorry, they'll give us the baseline neutral evolutionary rate, and then the non-synonymous changes would be a signal that's sort of responsible, or selection is sort of responsible for that signal in the non-synonymous rate of evolution. McDonald and Kreitman developed a very influential and important test that looks at the differences in rates of evolution within and between species to detect selection. There's also cool tests that emphasize hitchhiking effects. So if recombination's not perfect and an adaptive mutation occurs, it takes a whole lot of neutral variation along for the ride. And that's called a selective sweep, and this leaves a very distinctive trace in the genome. The last sort of set of tests I'll mention involve looking at the frequency spectrum. So what this does is it takes a number of sampled sequences of some gene and looks at the frequency of alleles in that sample. That's called the frequency spectrum. And that test is nice because it can be done just within a single species, and it's perhaps the most popular set of tests. And those are the sets of tests that I'm gonna look closely at. Okay. So how do you get a frequency spectrum? You need to sample DNA sequences of the same gene or genes from several individuals within a species. You then need to align those, no small feat, but suppose you can, compare those sequences, and then determine the number of alleles in that sample, also called the number of segregating sites. So each point in the gene, each base, has the potential for being a segregating site. So once you align all these sequences, if there's any difference, so if you have 20, and say there's at site 287, they're all T's except one sequence has an A, that's a segregating site. Now we also want to determine the frequency of those segregating sites in the sample. So some only occur once, some segregating sites occur two or three times in the sample, and the frequency spectrum is the distribution of the number of segregating sites that occur in a specific frequency in the sample data, right? So I'm going to go through that a bit more precisely, and then I'll give you a picture, which is by far the easiest way to understand this stuff. All right. So more precisely, this is a distribution of the number of sites X at the same frequency across a sequence sample of size N, right? So what we want to do is we want to know how many sites occur once in our 20 samples, how many sites occur twice, three times, right? And the expectation, given neutrality, is that you're going to see most of the changes are going to occur once. About half as many are going to occur twice. About a third as many are going to occur three times, and so on. The exact number is going to depend on this factor, which is called the neutral parameter theta, which is a product of the mutation rate, so that's what's creating new variation over time, and the effective population size. That's important. That's a representation of all the demographic factors that might affect molecular evolution. So it's called effective population size because it's not the actual population size. It's going to be different. Fluctuations in population size lower the effective population size. Unequal males and females, assortative mating structures. There's a lot of demographic factors that are sort of packed into this any value. So that itself is sort of an idealization. It's a summary statistic of a whole set of demographic factors that might affect evolution. Okay, the picture. Right? So this is a frequency spectrum for a sample of 20 sequences, and so you've got the number of segregating, samples in which the segregating site occurs, right? So if you, so at 20, that means you've got, that's left off because that means they're all identical, so there's no segregating sites. But 19 is the most, so you might have a segregating site that occurs in 19 of your 20 samples, and then this is sort of a percentage, right? And so the neutral case is, let's see if I can find the laser, is the gray bars, right? So it just sort of starts, you're supposed to see a lot in just once, and then sort of drops off, right? Now, if you've got positive selections, there's some selection for some positive change in the genome, you're going to see less of the alleles at low frequency and more at high frequency, right? If there's a sweep, you're going to see a lot at low frequency because mutations just started, and then nothing in between, and then those guys that hitchhiked along with the adaptive mutation, right? So you see very indicative patterns in the frequency spectrum based on the kind of selection regime that's occurring. So this is from a review article based on this Sawyer and Hartle model. I'll talk a bit more about that in a second. Okay, so how do you find signatures in the frequency spectrum? So that's the spectrum. We get it by doing a comparative analysis of a sample of DNA sequences from within a species. Tajima's D test is a common statistical test for the frequency spectrum. It's perhaps the most widely used test. So Mike Dietrich, a historian at Dartmouth, has done a literature analysis and quantified how often certain tests get used, and this is a report he gave me that the Tsushima's D test is the most widely used one. And it's also used extensively on human DNA. So Carlson, Nielsen, and Alexic, that's a review paper, the last one, have used these tests extensively on human DNA. Okay, what does this test do? It effectively compares two different estimates of the neutral parameter, that theta. And those estimates are sensitive to different features of the frequency spectrum. So the two estimates are roughly the number of segregating sites you see and the average number of pairwise nucleotide differences. Right? So both of those will give you an estimate of theta, but they're going to be sensitive to different features of sequence evolution. Okay. The D statistic compares the difference between those two estimates and normalizes it, right? And it gives these very nice, clean expectations. So you feed in the frequency spectrum and you get a D statistic out the end. If it's close sufficiently to zero, you have neutral evolution. If it's less than zero, that means there's purifying selection. There's a lot of deleterious mutations that are occurring and being culled from the population. If it's greater than zero, then that's evidence that there was an adaptive mutation that took hold and swept to fixation. So it's a nice test. It gives you clear results. And it looks like now we can actually detect what evolutionary processes occurred in the past by looking at the sequence, the extant sequence data. That's pretty cool. Okay, but that was in the details. So I'm going to take a closer look. So the D-test, as with all of these molecular tests for selection, presuppose a sequence evolution model. And this is a model of how DNA sequences evolve over time. They're idealized, they're highly mathematical, they involve a range of parameters from just one to dozens. The sequence evolution model is essential for determining these precise patterns, right? So it's not a dispensable assumption to these tests. You just have to make significant idealizations about the evolutionary process, right? So we're trying to reconstruct evolution over tens of thousands or millions of years, right? We're going to have to make idealizations about the rate of mutation over that long time span, how that rate might change, and how the demographics have affected molecular evolution over that time span, right? So the test detects patterns in these spectra, either by detecting a departure from the neutral spectrum or by detecting specific spectra that are indicative of different regimes of selection. This is commonly done using, so I said I'd come back to the Sawyer and Hartle model, a model that they developed called the Poisson random field model. So this is a model of sequence evolution that allows for neutral evolution and then a random, rarely occurring adaptive mutation. Right? This helps give us a sort of background expectation about what we should see across the genome, and then it's against this background expectation that then we can generate different frequency spectra if different selection regimes are in operation. Right? So this is the model that Nielsen used to generate those example spectra in his review article that I showed you earlier. Right? Okay, so the Poisson random field model, there's a number of parameters that have to go into it. How do we specify those? Well, originally, in the 90s, we would just stipulate them. We would stipulate the model, and then we would stipulate parameter values using some background theory or some background information about what we think mutations like or demographics are like in a particular species. So fruit flies, conjectures, they haven't gone through a big bottleneck in their recent evolutionary history, so we'll just assume large N, right? These, of course, are problematic, especially when we are interested in human paleobiology. Nowadays, the standard approach is to select the model, the sequence evolution model, and the parameter values based on molecular data, right? So this relies on model selection statistics. So you use your molecular data to help determine the model of sequence evolution and the values of the parameters that model requires, and then you use that to generate the frequency spectra to check whether selection, whether you have signatures of selection in that molecular data, right? So this is a better strategy, but there's still some risks involved. Model selection statistics are somewhat controversial. So biologists often use the shotgun approach where they use them all and hope for convergence. Also, there's some epistemic risk because you're using the same molecular data to develop your sequence evolution model that you then go back to check to see if you can find any signatures of selection. So I think there are ways to mitigate that risk, but it's always going to be a risk when you use these model selection statistics. Okay, so that's what's going on in the background of these tests. So the tests do something cool, but then there's a limitation because of this assumption of the sequence evolution model. So what's the cool thing they do? We use DNA polymorphism data, extant DNA polymorphism data. So we could sequence all of our genomes and compare them and do some evolutionary tests with the Tajima's D statistic, right? But because it presumes this sequence evolution model, and those sequence evolution models depend at the very least on that neutral parameter theta, sometimes there are more parameters involved, artifactual signatures can be generated. So an artifactual signature of positive selection can be produced by a population size decrease. Right? That's going to create a spectra that looks like there's been positive selection. But really all that's happened is the population has decreased. Same with purifying selection. If the population explodes, it will look like there's purifying selection across the genome. But that's artifactual. There's been no selection. The population's just growing. So what happens is when the population explodes, you get a preponderance of rare mutations. When it decreases, you get a preponderance of frequent mutations. And so these demographic fluctuations can confound the test for selection. So there's a persistent challenge when deploying these molecular tests to help constrain or assist paleobiological research. We need to estimate or constrain the demographic parameters. So this is really challenging. I mean, in part, so demographic fluctuations affect the whole genome, whereas selection tends to be targeted at specific genes. Right, so the whole genome is going through if there's population size fluctuation, that's going to affect all the genes on the genome. Whereas selection is more discerning, let's say. This is why the tests work so well. We can detect the baseline rate of neutral evolution by looking at different parts of the genome and then see which genes are evolving faster than they should be. Right? But it also makes independent estimates of those background demographic parameters more difficult. How are we going to get it? How are we going to get independent information on that? Now, one thing that helps a lot is using functional information about what the genes do to constrain our inferences. That can help constrain the sequence evolution model. It can tell us what mutations are more or less likely. It can also help us sort of double check the detection method, right? And in the case of the application to humans, we've got the best evidence for recent selection on genes associated with diet and disease resistance. Right? Those genes have very clear functional roles that are well identified. As soon as we start talking about more developmentally distal traits or more complicated traits, more interesting but more complicated traits like intelligence or those sorts of higher cognitive capacities, much, much, much more difficult. We've got no real concrete functional information to offer the kinds of constraints that we might need, and we still don't have independent estimates about how human demography has changed over the last billion years. Okay, so that's the first case. Limitation, we want an independent estimate of these demographic parameters. That's hard to get. Okay, second case. All right, doing okay on time. So, second question, how do we think about the evolution of human cognitive complexity in connection with cooperation? Right? So, this is the legacy of the social intelligence hypothesis. So one early hypothesis about how humans evolved to be cognitively complex is that it was associated with our increased sociality. So Dunbar suggests that our social groups got larger, this increased the demands upon us, and we had to get smarter as a result. Humphreys is the man usually associated with the Machiavellian version of the arms race. We started hanging out in groups together, some guys started to cheat, and there was an arms race between cheating and detection of that cheating. So it looks like strategic social interactions played some, and probably the important role in the evolution of our cognitive complexity. So how might models of social interactions help constrain or inform research into human paleobiology about what actually led us to evolve into cognitively complex creatures? So there's been a lot of recent emphasis on cooperation, and today I'm going to focus on the hypotheses of two thinkers, Kim Strelny, philosopher, and his recent book, The Evolved Apprentice, makes an argument for the importance of cooperation in the evolution of human cognition. Tomasello and collaborators have done comparative developmental psychology, looking at kids, human kids versus chimps, and have also been making a case for the importance of cooperation in the evolution of human cognitive complexity. Okay. So, in both of these cases, cooperation is the key. And the idea is that ecological cooperation, or collaboration, as many theorists like to use these days, in small groups was the easy first step. Right? So the idea is that early on, the ancestors, the human lineage, lived in small groups, and then it became advantageous for us to cooperate in our foraging activities. Right? According to Tomasello's story, that cooperation quickly becomes obligate. We come to depend on that ecological cooperation. And this eventually leads to adaptations or a development of the ability for what he calls group-mindedness, right? Our ability to form joint intentions that allow us to coordinate complex activity. So once, you know, before we just share information on where the best grubs to be found, once we have the group-mindedness, we can sort of coordinate complex hunts and bring down that mammoth with our pointy sticks, which is really difficult to do, right? Strelny takes a slightly different tack. He sees information pooling as facilitating the productivity of cooperation. So we started helping each other out, and then we started saying, oh, hey, there's good tubers over there. Oh, there's good, you can catch squirrels over there. And this kind of information pooling was a sort of very advantageous, easy form of cooperation. This leads, there's sort of some nice complicated feedback loops, some simplifying to a great degree. With that said, this sort of broadly leads to adaptations for what Strelny calls high-fidelity cultural learning. This enables us to accumulate and maintain cultural cognitive capital, and then that further incentivizes our ability to learn fast and pass it on to our offspring. Once cooperation becomes entrenched and we start down these feedback loops, later, punishment and partner choice help enforce it. So partner choice is a kind of punishment. So we could punish you for defecting or cheating, or we could just choose not to hang out with you anymore or kick you out of the tribe, right? So those are both ways of enforcing cooperation once it's off the ground and defection then becomes tempting, say. So that's broadly speaking how the story is supposed to go, right? Now, these new hypotheses are premised on a whole legacy of evolutionary research into social behavior, and I can't do that legacy justice now. I'm just going to point to the convergence on a key result that's often credited with Hamilton, and it figures into Brian Skirm's philosophical work on the evolution of the social contract. Fletcher and Dovelli are theoretical biologists that have given it a contemporary gloss. And this is the idea that correlated interaction of behaviors is the key to the evolution of cooperation. How do we get cooperation off the ground? Well, what you need are cooperators to play and hang out with other cooperators and exclude those defectors somehow. Right? So sort of a broad, formal point about the evolution of cooperation. But there's a lurking danger here. And this is a danger that William Hamilton, the evolutionary biologist, came to realize after he started hanging out and talking to George Price. That is, the mechanism that can generate the kind of correlated interaction that would help cooperation can also generate the conditions that facilitate the evolution of not-so-great behaviors, in particular what Hamilton called spite, and this is costly harming behavior. So the same mechanisms that can help for the evolution of cooperation can help the evolution of spite, where I actually pay a cost to hurt you. Then I can get a relative advantage if you're hurt worse than the cost I have to incur to inflict that harm. Okay. So just a few words about how those correlations are generated. Right, so that's sort of a broad, formal point about the evolution of cooperation. How is it really generated in real biological systems? Okay, one of the primary ways of investigating this is to look at conditional behavior, right? So I think Richard Dawkins coined the phrase greenbeard. So a greenbeard gene is a gene that causes me to behave altruistically or cooperatively towards guys with green beards, and also causes me to have a green beard. So then we can go around the population, and if you've got the same marker, I help you out. If you don't, you don't, right? So there you get the evolution of sort of a perfectly conditional behavior with the marker. Direct reciprocity, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. Indirect reciprocity, keeping track of reputation. Do you have a reputation for being a cooperator or not? If you do, I'll hang out with you. If not, no. And then partner choice models that, so developed long ago, but then have become popular these days, lately, especially popular this lately. So maybe I go around and I meet you on the street and we make a decision about whether to hang out and cooperate together. And if you're a defector, I recognize that and say no thanks, but if you're another cooperator, then we hang out together. This can facilitate the evolution of cooperation. And there are many other mechanisms. So conditional behavior is just one way to do it. We could signal. There could be spatial structure or group structure in the population. And also, small population or group size matters. And this matters in two ways. So one, stories about the evolution of human cognitive complexity involve cooperation in small groups in the beginning as being easy. And two, something Hamilton realized, small groups make spite more dangerous. So if there's just small population size, me, as a spider, if I can make sure I hurt everybody else in the population, I might be able to get ahead a little bit and generate a relative advantage. So spite can show up and evolve in small groups. Okay, but I want to focus on conditional behaviors, and I want to look at two games. So here I'm just going to sort of pose a counterexample to this, not really a counterexample, but another way of thinking about the evolution of cooperation that casts maybe some doubt on the usual story, right? And this is based on new research that I've been working on in collaboration with Rory Smead at Northeastern. Okay, so let's think of two games, help and harm. So the help game is the prisoner's dilemma, right? This is usually used to represent altruism. I pay a cost to help you out. You have the option of being an egoist where you just take whatever help I offer but don't pay any cost to return the favor, right? So that's the help game. Altruists versus altruists, you both pay the cost, you both get the benefit. Egoists reap the benefit, don't pay the cost. Altruists, when they run into egoists, have to pay a cost. They don't get anything back. Egoists just leave each other be. Alright, there's a game, a sort of corresponding game in which we can think of spite. And this is what Brian Skirms has called the prisoner's delight. Right? So, egoism, or you might call it the social strategy, is the best strategy in this case. But you could pay a cost to inflict a harm. So spiteful guys pay a cost to inflict a harm on their partner instead of paying a cost to help a guy. Right? So in both these cases, conditional behavior can help the evolution of altruism in the help game and spite in the harm game. Right? So the way it would go is something like this. In the help game, help other altruists. If you recognize them, they are altruists, help them out. If they're an egoist, don't. In the spite game, you spite the egoists. If you run into a fellow spider, you guys stand down. Sort of recognize that you're both spiteful types, so you don't spite each other, but you spite the egoists and drive them out of the population. Okay, now, the evolution of conditional behavior presupposes recognition of some sort of the behavioral type, of the actual individual, of their past behavior, of their reputation. Somehow you need to recognize some fact about the person you're interacting with and behave accordingly. So let's look at the coevolution of recognition and conditional behavior. So this is a study that looks at the coevolution of neutral markers and marker-based conditional behavior. What Speed and I do is we look at a model of coevolution of conditional strategies and a continuous recognition parameter. So the idea is that our recognition ability or the conditionality of behavior is going to co-evolve with our ability to use that conditional behavior in the help and the harm games. Okay, so first, consider how conditional behavior helps both cases. So two populations, Suppose we start with all conditional altruism and help, and all conditional spite and harm. Then we let recognition evolve. First, in the help game, something strange happens. Recognition starts to decay. It's selected against in help. Why? So we're all conditional helpers. We all recognize that we're altruists and we help each other out. But then if I just sort of decide not to recognize you as a fellow helper, I avoid paying a cost, but then I receive your help in return. So it allows for a covert egoism, right? So I say, well, I'm not really sure you're a helper, so I'm just going to be an egoist. And so what you get is selection against recognition in the help game. Not so in the harm game, right? So if you've got all conditional spiders, we all recognize that we're conditional spiders, and we don't engage in that harmful behavior. As soon as if I make a mistake, that's bad for everyone. So mistakes are going to be penalized in the harm game, whereas they're weirdly rewarded in the help game, because it allows for this covert egoism. You're avoiding a cost. But in the harm game, you're all recognizing each other as fellow harmers, and so no actual harm is being perpetrated. So what if we combine the games? How am I doing on time? All right, I might need to accelerate a little bit. I can talk more about this in question period if people are interested. But you can combine help and harm into a single Bayesian game, where you play help with probability P, and otherwise you play harm. Then there are going to be four strategies. You can be an egoist in both. You can be a conditional altruist in help, egoist in harm. You can be a conditional spider in harm, egoist in help. Or you can be a doubly conditional guy, right? So they're going to help you if they recognize you as a C-type in help, and harm you if you're not a C-type in harm. So what happens? Oh, a little more details about the model. So the population is going to be represented by two vectors. One's a vector of type frequencies of those four strategies, and one's a vector for the recognition ability. So the ability can range from 0 to 1, 1 being perfect recognition, 0 being perfect anti-recognition, so a half is random. The individuals are going to meet at random, but then the recognition kicks in and they can decide whether or not to behave appropriately. And then evolution is going to occur simultaneously on the strategies and on the recognition parameter. And here's what we found. So altruists, conditional altruists, they don't do well at all. All right. So we did 1,000 simulations for each of these cases, right? So altruists never evolve. In every case, so this is the So this is the probability of playing the help game. So down here, you're playing the help game 20% of the time, and the harm game 80% of the time, and here, vice versa, right? So in any case, if the spiders get a hold, if the conditional spiders get a hold, that's that brown bar, they stay in control. So spite's very stable if it occurs, but it occurs rarely. What's interesting is that when you play help more than harm, the egoists almost always win. Right? So then there's just no social behavior being exhibited. Everyone becomes an egoist. If you're playing harm more than help, you get those conditional, doubly conditional guys. Right? So what's going on here? You need to be playing harm sufficiently frequently for there to be a selection pressure on high recognition. Once there's that selection pressure on high recognition, and if C's get a hold of the population, they can maintain it. They help each other in help, and they harm each other in harm. But there's got to be lots of armor, or they check to see if they're the same and harm different in harm. But there has to be a lot of instances of the harm game being played so that they can combat the covert egoism that undermines the conditional altruists in the help game. Okay, so what's the upshot? So the standard story, the one that I was attributing to Tomasello and Strelny and many theorists about the evolution of human cooperation and cognitive complexity, is that cooperation evolves first in favorable conditions, followed by punishment to enforce it. And punishment's often interpreted as altruism, and it poses a second-order free rider problem. So punishing someone is costly, it benefits everyone, so it generates a public good. So shouldn't we see punishment disappear to the threat of egoism, just like we see altruism? So that's the standard approach. But if you take seriously the evolution of spite, there's an alternative to the standard story. Conditional spite might evolve first, stabilize recognition, and then allow for cooperation to evolve later. Or it might co-evolve with conditional altruism. So it looks like that conditional harming behavior might be an important condition on the evolution of cooperation. So this scenario reverses the order of evolution. Conditional harming may have evolved first, and it may be crucial for maintaining the very mechanisms that enable cooperation in the population. So here's the persistent challenge, and this is broadly and egregiously summarizing and simplifying, but here it goes. The evolution of social behavior is a complicated affair, right? We knew that already, but I've shown you another wrinkle. And more formal work needs to be done before it can provide any help to paleobiological research. So here we go. We've got this legacy on the evolution of social behavior and the importance and ease of the evolution of cooperation. People have plugged it in to accounts of human paleobiology and how we might have evolved our cognitive complexity. But now, if you take seriously the evolution of spite, it seems to put a wrinkle in that whole assumption. The reliance on these background models of cooperation, I mean, I don't want to say it's unjustified. It's just we need to think it through. There's a lot more complexities that need to be worked out before we can rely on it to help guide and constrain paleobiological research, especially with respect to humans. Okay, so let me wrap up. So what should our attitude be towards the usefulness of evolutionary modeling for paleobiology? Well, in the first case, I think we should have an optimistic attitude. I think the molecular test for selection can be really important, right? And relatedly, I haven't mentioned this, but this is connected to issues with molecular clocks and making the dating from molecular clocks cohere with the dating from fossils, right? But I think our attitude towards the use of models, particularly in as applied to molecular tests for selection, should be optimistic, especially when we can augment that with information on gene function. Right. Ideally, we'd want that demographic information, but if we can get information on gene function, that can help constrain the test sufficiently to help us identify evidence for selection, and then that can help inform what we thought was going on in the actual evolutionary past. But regarding the second case on cooperation and cognitive complexity, I'm, at least at the moment, a little less optimistic, because especially of the role spite might have played in the evolution of social behavior, particularly in humans. Right? Humans were really good at learning. We learned fast. We're sensitive to success. And if we lived in small groups, maybe there was a lot of spite going around early on. Maybe cooperation didn't evolve first in easy conditions. Maybe it was spite. More work needs to be done. I mean, these are just formal models. What we need is to find evidence about what sorts of social behaviors were in operation in the ancestor lineages to humans, and that's just really, really hard evidence to come by. Okay, and I said there was a coincidence. So here it is. I'm not sure if this is merely a coincidence or deeply revelatory. So I'm curious to hear what you think. So I've looked at very disparate instances of evolutionary model. Molecular sequence evolution versus the evolution of social behavior, group selection, evolutionary game theoretic models, right? But these disparate models both are missing a crucial component, and that's demographic information on population size and structure. So if we had that, we could constrain our test for selection, and we could make clearer judgments about whether spite was a threat, whether cooperation was easier to achieve, and how the social evolution may have unfolded to help produce the cognitively complex and interesting beings we are, right? Both of them are missing this key component. I didn't expect to discover that, but that seems to be a point of commonality between the two instances of modeling. And like I said, fascinating. I'm not sure if it's merely a coincidence or deeply revelatory. And it turns out, what little research I've done on group size over human history, it turns out it's very controversial. Nobody can seem to agree to the level of precision that we need to agree to be able to judge or constrain these sorts of models in the right sort of way. Okay. That's the end. Thanks very much.